Good morning, everyone. Welcome to week four. Oops. Yaakov? Sorry. Just technological issues here. Sorry, we'll start momentarily. Okay, sorry about that. Delayed just starting. Welcome to week four. It's within you. Just want to remind everyone that next week is the last session. I would have gone one more week, but I'm going to be away the following week. So next week we end the year. Then we take a big break. Not a break from learning. We can always learn and study. There's plenty to do. February the 6th. 6th of February will be the beginning of the new year. So get a really good refresh break and then we'll... Yes, that's like a 2-month break. Okay. Just want to also, I had it up on the screen before, to remind everyone, many of you might be interested, this coming Sunday night, Chaim Guggenheim, who is the Vice President of the Forestine, you might remember we once had on Thursday morning, Rafi Forestine, who spoke, it was very, very amazing. So he's also on the board, he's actually his brother-in-law, and he's the Vice President. And what he's going to do, is actually going to teach, he's going to teach us something, using one of the methods, like the tools of Forestine. I think it should be very, very interesting for men and women, so please come along. Okay, just before we start today's topic, I thought I'd just share something with you, just something that I came across this week. It might be a bit older, I'm not sure, but because it's remotely, well, not remotely, it's sort of indirectly related to the topic also about selflessness and not being wrapped in ourselves and so on, but it's got to do with listening, and it's an amazing lesson of picking up the cues. And I mentioned it particularly because this week is the week that there's an awareness about domestic violence and things like that, and this is a related video, and it's got to do about listening and generally, but in a broader sense, about picking up the cues when people need help and not always people are able to express it properly, but... So just have a look at it and you'll see. Put the light on. Can we turn the... Oh, it's right on.
Sorry, I got 911.
I would like to order a pizza.
You called 911 to order a pizza? Wrong number to call for a pizza.
No, you're not.
In
his 14 years of service, this is a call Oregon dispatcher Tim Tenick has never gotten before.
You see it on Facebook, but it's not something that anybody has ever been trained for. We're just trained to listen.
He says domestic violence calls are common, but not like this.
The other guy still there?
Yeah. I need a large pizza.
All right. How about medical? You need medical?
No.
After this exchange, Tenick alerted officers to hurry.
Turn your sirens off before you get there. Call or order a pizza. And agreed with everything I said. There was domestic violence.
Tenick says his intuition that something wasn't right kicked in, which to him reaffirms how important listening is in his line of work.
Thank you. How can I help you? Yeah. Other dispatchers that I've talked to not have picked up on this. They told me they wouldn't pick up on this.
Excellent dispatch work on the part of a dispatcher. Some dispatchers may have hung up.
Oregon Police Chief Michael Navarre told me that ordering a pizza to indicate domestic violence is something he's never heard of.
Yeah, not my ears, not my 42 years boss.
But coming up with some kind of code to alert 911 that you're in trouble is the right thing to do. The chief says if you ever find yourself in a similar situation, here's what you should do.
Somehow or another, convey to that police dispatcher that you're in trouble. And this woman did that. She did that not with her words, but with the tone of her voice.
Thanks to the quick thinking of both the caller and the dispatcher, the alleged abuser, Simon Lopez, was arrested and locked up.
He handled the call beautifully and had a happy ending.
So I just thought it's such a beautiful thing. But I think it has a broader lesson as well. I think it's not only in case of emergency. Just a general listening thing. That sometimes when people are in need, it doesn't have to be an emergency like this. It could be anything. It could be between friends. It could be, right? Sometimes people find it hard to reach out and to be explicit and expressive about what they actually need. And just sometimes about picking up the tone of voice and the cues. And it's a real listening lesson. I thought it was fantastic. I thought I'd share it with you. Okay. So back to the topic. Working through the book, this book, we've been talking about just a bit of review from the last couple of weeks to bring us up to date. So we've been defining the concept of self-worth and inner value. Talk about the two models of outside in and inside out. So the outside in is when we define our self-worth by the approval of others and the perception of others, which normally results in ego and insecurity. Whereas within means we acknowledge our intrinsic value. My inner worth creates the reality outside of me, which brings to selflessness and humility, as we discussed at length last week. Now, for the last 2 weeks, we've been talking about behaviors that we can engage in that help us create that mindset of the inside-out model. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about the concept of hiding versus showing up. Hiding means not being honest, hiding parts of ourselves because we're worried about the perception of others. That leads to just more seeking and doesn't actually create good relationships, whereas showing up equals finding, but we talked about being honest but not tactless. And last week, we looked at another behavior. So just to summarize last week's discussion, we explained the following. We said that the pathway to the inside-out model was also tapping into a life of meaning and purpose. So what happens normally is that the outside-in model is ego and self-absorption, which leads to pleasure and emptiness. We're always protecting our fragile self, and therefore we do what's good for us now in terms of other people's perceptions, in terms of responses, in terms of what makes us feel good, and it's an outcome of our ego, which is just leads to emptiness and no meaning and no purpose and emptiness. Whereas the inside-out model is tapping into that core essence of our soul, which seeks meaning and purpose, which allows us to go beyond ourselves, allows us to be selfless, and leads to a life of meaning and purpose. So it's a concept about not taking ourselves so seriously so that we can go beyond ourselves and connect to things on the outside, connect to things that are higher, and so on. Now, we explained last week that the outside-in model and the inside-out model, the mindsets live in our consciousness. The outside-in model is more emotional. It's our emotional response to what's happening outside. The inside-out model is more something we have to work out in our intellect and lives in the mind. However, they have their sources, they have their roots, the origin in the subconscious, right? So we explained that the consciousness of emotion is really tapped into and connected to the subconscious of our animal soul, right? The animal soul, which is the animalistic part of who we are, the animal part of who we are, and so on and so forth. Whereas the consciousness of intellect is rooted more in the godly soul, which is the need to connect to something higher, the need to connect to meaning, to purpose, and selflessness, and so on. So we explain, therefore, that the way to tap into that soul, meaning to tap into that part of us that leads us to be more selfless and not take ourselves so seriously and not focus on ourselves and be self-absorbed, but to go beyond ourselves, connect to others, expand into something greater, to values, and so on, is to engage in the behavior of self-control. That's what we explained last week, right? Because self-control allows us not to respond emotionally. Emotions work quicker than the intellect does. Our impulses, our natural responses are more emotional. Those are the responses that normally come from the animal part of who we are, from the ego part of who we are. Whereas if we delay gratification or we have self-control in our responses, that allows us to have the intellectual space to be able to think what is the right response, what's the moral thing to do, what's the selfless thing to do, what's the meaningful and purposeful thing to do. And we talked about it in two different models, which is in terms of the pleasure which we have, in terms of the things which we use to give ourselves pleasure, just to exercise and to get used to the concept of delayed gratification. Just that space itself is very, very powerful because it allows us to think about why we're doing this and why do we need to engage in it, and nothing wrong with pleasure, but is it going to be consistent and strengthen and enhance a life of meaning, or is it going to be contrary to the life of meaning, and so on. And then there's the power of space, which is in our responses to other people. Right? So that was a very, very important formula they went through, that whatever happens, when things happen, there's the event, there's the way we judge the event, naturally speaking. There's the feeling of being upset, being angry, being frustrated, and so on and so forth, which normally leads to a negative response, but then there's the space. And that space is the power of the space where we have the control to ensure that we can process what should be the response rather than what do I want the response to be, which is that space is where we switch from the selfish response, the impulsive response, the egocentric response, to a response which is moral, which is ethical, which is valuable, which is effective, which will bring meaning and purpose, right? So it's these behaviors, just practicing that space and practicing delayed gratification and practicing self-control, that allows us to bypass the ego part of who we are and to connect to the depth of who we are, which is the soul, which is the point and the origin of selflessness and humility, which allows us to then develop that mindset of understanding the intrinsic value, which is our soul, which is the real identity of who we are, in order to live an inside-out model. All right, remember that? That was just a quick summary. Okay. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to discuss some more important ideas which are connected to this, which, again, sort of just enhance and strengthen what we spoke about last week to get us to that inside-out mindset. Right? So one of the things that the author discusses in the book, is the concept of freedom. Freedom of the mind, really. Right? I saw him quote a very cute little quote from Eisenhower, the President Eisenhower, and he said the following. He said, "If you want total security, go to prison. There you're fed, clothed, given medical care, and so on. The only thing lacking is freedom." Right? So sometimes we give ourselves everything that we need except for freedom. So we know, we've talked about this before, one of the things that we have in the Torah, in Jewish tradition, in Jewish thinking, it's very interesting, that one of the fundamental mitzvot that we have in Jewish practice, for many reasons, but including the one we'll discuss, is the commandment on a daily basis to remember the Exodus from Egypt. Every single day, we're supposed to. Not only Pesach is when we do it in an emphasized way, but there are things we do every day that we remember, to help us remember the going out of Egypt. The Shema, for example. When we say the Shema has three paragraphs. The third paragraph ends with remembering the going out of Egypt. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I'm your God, says God, that took you out of Egypt, and so on, right? On Kiddush Friday night, many mitzvot, we mention the phrase, Zecher Liyitziat Mitzrayim. Remembering the going out of Egypt. Kiddush Friday night has that. Kiddush on the Chagim have that. Right? Many mitzvot have that connection to the going out of Egypt. Right? Why is that? Not only because it's the genesis of the Jewish journey, but it's deeper than that. It's the journey of the Jewish people from slavery to freedom. And we know, we've talked about this many times, we're not talking about physical slavery, we're talking about spiritual slavery, emotional slavery, intellectual slavery, psychological freedom, right? And it's the gift that was given to us when we left Egypt, not to be imprisoned, which means not to live a life of victimhood, of servitude, of slavery, inner slavery, not to be slaves to our impulses, to our desires, to our temptations, not to be slaves to other people's responses, perceptions, right? Circumstances that happen outside of us, but whatever happens, the ability to be free. And that only comes, of course, with what we've been talking about, that concept of the inside-out model. In other words, when we live an outside-in model where everything is defined and created and directed by the things and the perceptions that happen outside of us, that is total slavery. Because we keep on going from one thing to another, always worrying about how is the outside having an effect on me, right? Because we're protecting that fragile self. Essentially what that means is we're totally imprisoned. Right? the life of freedom, meaning spiritual freedom, intellectual freedom, emotional freedom, means leaving the outside-in model and engaging in the inside-out model. In other words, it means leaving the model where we're totally slaves to the animalistic part of who we are, which is very insecure and very fragile and very affected by the outside, and moving into that soul-oriented life where we're moving from within, right? The things we talked about last week. Because that's the concept. In other words, if we live a life based on the animal soul, so then that gives us insecurity, paranoia, we define our self-worth by the outside, and so on and so forth. Now, what's important is this. This is not easy. In other words, like this. To switch our mindset, we can do that, and we can even do that on a constant basis. It's feeling that mindset. It's really learning to be okay with, comfortable with, defining ourselves from inside out. And just talking about the Yitziat Mitzrayim model, talking about the Exodus from Egypt model, we find in history a fascinating thing. That when the Jews left Egypt, right, numerous times, if you read the Chumash, if you read the Torah stories, when everything's got tough, numerous times they complained to Moses, why did you take us out of Egypt? Or can we go back to Egypt? Or in Egypt things were better because we had free cucumbers or something like that, right? No, that's a real verse, by the way. Right? It was one time that they got insecure about having food and they said, Zacharnu et ha-kishuim, we remember the cucumbers or things that we had for free, right? In fact, I'll tell you an interesting thought. I wasn't part of my script, but I'll share with you. It's a beautiful idea. One of the things the Jewish people said when they complained to Moses, they said, we remember the various foods that we ate in Mitzrayim chinam. We ate for free. Right? We were given it for free. I mean, never mind that they had to work from morning to evening, but we were given for free, right? What does that mean? So on a deeper level, the commentaries explain that when you live a life of Mitzrayim, when you live a life of imprisonment, right? Part of that life is looking for chinam. We want everything to come for free, which is like the over-obsession with pleasure-seeking. Right? We don't want to invest effort. We don't want to work hard. We don't want to go beyond ourselves. In other words, part of the outside-in model, part of the pleasure-seeking model is just doing whatever's good for me now, not having to work. That's why it's so hard to delay gratification if you live the outside-in model. That's why self-control is so important. I don't want to work hard. You know, it would be more effective if you kept quiet for a few minutes and thought about your response. I don't want to do that. I just want to say what I want to say because that's easier for me. It makes me feel good now. It means I don't have to work. I just blurt it out. I'm feeling angry. I let you have it. And I'm done. I'm not done because at the end of the day, it actually is ineffective and it breeds unhappiness. But I'm done now, right? So that phrase, we ate the foods in Egypt, chinam, for nothing, actually has something, it's a very important message. It's the life of Mitzrayim, the life of imprisonment is a life where you look for chinam. Going back to that comment about prison, in prison also you get everything for nothing. But it's slavery, right? But the fascinating thing is that the Jews kept complaining to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses, about why did he take us out of Egypt? Why? Because as long as we live, we're always going to have the struggle. This is the important thing to understand. We're always going to have the struggle. We're always going to have the temptation of slipping back into the outside-in model, slipping back into the slavery. Why? Because most of us never transform the animal soul. The animal soul still remains an animal. We dominate the animal soul. We put it under control. We channel it. We let our godly soul perhaps dominate the process, hopefully. Direct the process, inspire the journey. But it never goes away. And every so often, that animal jumps up again and says, let me have a go. Right? That's the way the human experience works. Which is okay, because that's why God designed us. We have to always be on the alert. That's why we always have to revisit these concepts. We might even have achieved freedom. We might even achieved a couple of days where we're very in touch with our intrinsic worth. We're very in touch with the inside-out model, and suddenly it slips. Just like the Jewish people. Suddenly we complain again. No, I don't want to work hard. I don't want to be free. I don't want to have selflessness. I want to go the other route. Right? So that's an important thing to understand. So in the book, he tells a very beautiful story, which I read for the first time here. And he says, Natan Sharansky, I'm sure you've heard of him, right? Natan Sharansky was a refusnik in Russia, in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. And he was denied a visa to leave the country. Now, Sharansky is a very strong-willed person. I don't know if you've read his books. They're beautiful. They're very amazing stuff, right? So they tried to break him. What they would do is the Russians, Soviets, they would always send two people to interrogate him. Why would they send two people? I don't know if you know how it used to work under communism. Everyone was spying on everyone else. So they used to always send two people because they were worried that he would develop a relationship with one person. Mm-hmm. With two people, they would be very careful because each one knew the other one's watching, right? That's how it used to work. Mm-hmm. So one time, just a beautiful little description of freedom. One time, as he was being interrogated, Sashuransky repeatedly interrupted the officers, and he says, I want to tell you a joke. There's a prisoner being interrogated. He says, I need to tell you a joke. Of course, they wouldn't let him. But there was one point where they paused for long enough that he was able to start his joke. So what was the joke? The joke was that Brezhnev, the former premier of the Soviet Union, wasn't known to be a very intelligent guy, right? So he told him the joke. He told the officers the joke that during the Cold War, he wanted to outdo the Americans. So he called his Russian cosmonauts and he told them, we must outdo the Americans. We're going to be the first country to send cosmonauts to the sun. Right? So they said to him, don't you realize, Mr. Brezhnev, that before we even get halfway there, we'll be burnt up by the heat of the sun. So he replies, he says, don't you think I'm a fool? Do you think I'm a fool? I've of course thought about all that. We're going to send you at night. So when he finished his joke, he began, so he tells the joke, Sharansky, it's a very cute story. So he tells the joke and he starts to laugh. He starts to laugh like at his own joke, right? And of course, they're not laughing because each one is scared to laugh because the other guy, right? And they're stone-faced, not laughing because the one guy could say he laughed at a joke at Brezhnev, he can go to Siberia, you never know. So then he's laughing and he stops laughing. He says to them, I'd like to ask you a question. I'm the prisoner, and yet I can sit here and laugh at this joke. Meanwhile, the two of you are the free ones, yet each of you is terrified to laugh in front of the other one. So I wonder, which one of us is really the prisoner? So it's a beautiful story. So he ends off and he says, this is the powerful testimony to the meaning of a truly free life. As we've talked about in many, many different contexts, freedom has actually, at the end of the day, nothing to do with the circumstances around us. Right? Freedom has everything to do with our inner response, which of course was the whole theme of The Choice when we did that series from Edith Eger, right? In other words, freedom has to do with the inside-out model. Freedom has to do with understanding who we really are, understanding our true worth, understanding our intrinsic value, understanding the spark of the soul, and understanding that spark of the soul is always free. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was the one famous story was he was arrested in the former Soviet Union for spreading Yiddishkeit. He was imprisoned. And actually was originally sentenced to hanging or to death. And miraculously he was saved, but they originally freed him, and then every word was watched and everything was watched, and he was a very big thorn in the communist side because he just defied them all the time in terms of building underground places of learning and spreading Yiddishkeit and so on. So when he was freed, his death sentence was taken away, but he was sentenced to 12 years in exile in a very far away little city called Kostroma. And he was given permission to go home just for a few hours from jail, and then he would get on a train and he would go to Kostroma. These Hasidim in Russia, his followers, got wind of the fact that he was free, and hundreds, perhaps thousands of them gathered at the train station, which was illegal to do at that time, to just have a glimpse of him and say farewell to him before he goes into exile. So he came down the train platform, and before the train went, he turned around and he gave a talk, which was in complete defiance of the authorities, right? He was very strong about not letting himself become imprisoned. And one of the things he said at that talk, a very, very famous talk, in which he said he knows that there's people here that are spying on him because they used to send Yiddish-speaking communists to pick up every word that he was saying and so forth. And one of the things he said, he quoted from his father, who said the following when he talked about exile, right? We had a temple, the Jewish people were free in the land of Israel and so on, and then we were sent into exile. And he said that his father used to say that only our bodies were sent into exiles, our soul was never ever sent into exile, right? In other words, the body is the one, the body or the animal soul part of, the physical part of us, is the part of us which is affected by the outside surroundings. But if we understand that the true us, The true identity, the true spark of who we really are is not the body, it's the soul. Then we know that we're always free. Because that spark of the soul is always free. It's never put down, it's never insecure, it's not affected by the outside surroundings. It is who it is. It is that part of the soul that seeks meaning, that seeks purpose, that seeks a divine connection, and that seeks to do good, irrespective of what's happening outside of us. And the freedom, the feeling of freedom. Sharansky felt more free than the officers, even though his circumstances weren't free at all. Edith Eger talks about that, where she made that choice to feel free, irrespective of the terrible, terrible surroundings that she was in. Of course, this is, of course, the philosophy, as we've talked about many, many times, of man's search for meaning by Viktor Frankl, the same idea, that no matter what people do to you, they can take everything away from you, but they can't take away your freedom. But that freedom is only if we have an inside-out model, right? It is hard, yes. That's why we need to talk about it again and again. That is
imagine
correct.
Being in a camp in Auschwitz.
Correct.
And
correct.
Saying I'm free.
Yes, so Viktor Frankl writes that he says that it wasn't the case for everyone there, but he said the fact that some people were able to live like that is a testament that ultimately that is possible for a human being to do. And that's hard, you're right. That's exactly what he writes. That's correct. Right. Now, how do we get there, right? So there are behaviors. We've talked about the behaviors, showing up, being honest, self-control, delayed gratification. But then there's another concept which is connected to this, and this is sort of what I want to elaborate a bit on. And there's a chapter in the book by Eileen Cohen, the co-author of the book, where she talks about what she calls living intentionally. Right? Living intentionally. Which is like the real meaning, the true meaning of mindfulness, really, mindful living, right? And she talks about a client that she had who was very frustrated because she was engaging in ineffective behavior, destructive behavior. She would spend irresponsibly, she would respond angrily at siblings or at relatives and friends, and she always felt bad about it. And a lot of time, that's what we go through. In other words, we scream at someone, we get insulted, we say things we shouldn't say, and then we regret it because we know in our mind it's wrong, right? And I guess she was coming to her to sort of navigate that whole process of how do we actually get to some tachlis, how do we get to some space where we actually stop doing those kind of things, right? So the problem with this client, she called her Sarah, probably not her real name, is that she was so clear about her goals, right? She was clear about her values, she was clear about her principles, and she wasn't living by them, right? Which is a struggle that other people have. So she talks about the concept of living intentionally. What does living intentionally mean? Living intentionally means where we move from living on autopilot, which a lot of people live on, to living on purpose. Right? What does that mean? In other words, it's the expansion of the concept, really, which we talked about last week, of self-control or the space, the labor, right? All that becomes easier if we get ourselves generally into a mode of living on purpose, right? Now, it's a very hard thing today, as we spoke about 2 weeks ago, because we actually live in a world today where everyone is on autopilot a lot of the time because we have so much to do. We're running from one thing to another, right? How many of us actually stop and re-examine our values? Re-examine our mission statement, as Stephen Covey talks about it, right? How often do we actually to do that? Do we have time where we actually sit down and say, hold on a second, how's my life going? In other words, how often do we get off the treadmill? Right? We're going from one thing to another. Things are very, very fast moving today. Social media technology hasn't made it easy, as we know. Right? We have good intentions. We have good values. Many of us, we have things that we want to accomplish. Intrinsically, a lot of us do want to live with a higher purpose, and yet we're living on autopilot. And what happens when we live on autopilot is that every moment is just moving by. It's like exactly like a treadmill. It's just moving. And we're not in any of the moments, right? We're just going through each moment, but we're not there. Now, mindful living from a Jewish point of view, we talk about mindfulness, for example, is not just about being in the moment. It's about being in the moment with intention, being in the moment with a purpose, with a reason. What am I doing in this moment? What's this experience for? What Rabbi Sacks, we'll come back to it in a minute, what Rabbi Sacks calls the why of the moment. Right? Always, why am I doing this? How's this experience, or how's this moment, or how's this thing that I'm doing altogether, how is it consistent with my overall value system? How is it enhancing my life mission? Now, I know that we don't think about this all the time, but at least if we can get used to doing that a little bit, right? Even wake up in the morning and spending a few minutes to make a plan of the day. But part of the plan is not just a to-do list, because the to-do list can be just another treadmill to-do list. Oh, I've got 1,000 things there. Let me organize myself. Okay, take out a pen. In the morning, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. That's not a proper plan. Proper plan needs another dimension, another layer. Proper plan means, why am I doing all of this? Like, do I need to do this? Is that part important? No, it might be important. But I can't do this and that. So which one is more important? Which one is more consistent with my values? Which one is more consistent with my overall mission? Now, mission purpose comes from the inside. You know, a lot of times, for example, we choose one thing over another. Our priority system is crooked or ineffective, because sometimes actually we choose one thing over another not because of our value system. Sometimes we choose one thing over another because of what the outside is going to think, or what someone might think. I have to go there because otherwise that person is going to be disappointed, or they'll think badly of me. I should be doing something more important. I should be spending more time at home. I should be spending more time with my children, for example, or family, whatever the case is. I'm just giving examples. But often we do have conflicting priorities. Often we do have things that are pulling at us from all different directions, right? So living intentionally means we actually have to be there in every moment, number one, but with intention, with purpose. I just spent an hour. Is there a purpose in that hour, right? Which also goes together with the concept we've spoken about many times, understanding that there's a purpose in every experience. If I'm doing something, there must be a purpose in it. Even though it might seem meaningless, and it might seem just like a means to an end. We've spoken about this before, that in Jewish thinking, there's actually no such thing as a means to an end. Everything is by divine providence. Everything happens for a reason. Every moment of our life is meaningful and purposeful. And therefore, even if I have to get to something very important and I have to drive for an hour in a traffic jam to get there, that might be important. I have to make that hour meaningful. Once I make that hour meaningful, it's no longer frustrating. Now, I have to think about it. Each person will make that hour meaningful in a different way. It might be just zoning out so I can relax. It might be making a phone call and talking to someone about something important that I wouldn't be able to do before. It might be just talking to my kid who's sitting next to me and distracting. It might be listening to a shiur or listening to something very interesting and valuable and purposeful. Right? Or might be just strengthening myself by relaxing. Whatever that case is. But I'm going to be here for the next hour anyways. I'm going to be doing it. But I have to be doing it properly. I have to be there. I have to be in that moment. I have to be maximizing the potential in that moment. And I have to be there on purpose. I have to be there with intention. Right? In other words, that's that whole mindset of using our minds rather than just our impulses. Of thinking, of asking that question, why? Or what am I going to do about it? How am I going to make it more meaningful and purposeful? When we do that as a general rule, by the way, if that becomes our general outlook, it becomes so much easier then to exercise self-control, to exercise delayed gratification, because it becomes part of our general way of living, to live mindfully, not to rush from one thing to another, not to just go on autopilot, not to be on the treadmill. Yeah.
People say it's mindless, it's relaxing because it's mindless, which seems to be the opposite of mindfulness, but it also seems to be the antidote for like the pressure. So where does that...
Very good question. So there's actually two things there. So let me just respond. Actually, let me pick up on that because that's really good. So first of all, the pressure cooker, for example, that people go through, which is negative, often is negative because it's an outside-in model, not an inside-out model. Right? That's really important. Right? Now, kids in school, for example, or kids in college, whatever the case is, I think it's really important to do well and to work hard. Working hard, it's not about not working hard, this, by the way, right? Working hard is always a good thing. Adam, there's a verse that tells us Adam la amal yivaled, a person was born to toil, right? And there's often a confusion between hard work and stress. Stress is not, every time we work hard, that's not stress. That's good for us, right? The stress is different. The stress is about the fear of failure. The stress is, what are other people going to think? How are they going to rate me? How are they going to define me, right? Working hard means from within. Working hard means I'm going to work really hard in my exams, in my career, in my whatever the case is, because I want to do the best I can, and I'm going to push myself every year a little bit more because there's the growth mindset and neuroplasticity and everything like that, which is all true, right? But I'm going to do it from within. That would remove 80% of the stress if you just did that, right? That's number one. Number two, mindless activities are not necessarily bad as long as you do them mindfully. What, right? What I mean? No. I just came with that now, but that was. Thank you. No, because human beings are not machines. We do need downtime, right? You know, what's like. I think once, this many years ago, it's like those. Steve Covey has those four quadrants of time management, right? And I forgot what the fourth one is called. It's very good about, we do things that are just.
Not important,
whatever, right? And he says that it's an important quadrant, provided it doesn't control you. In other words, there's nothing wrong in saying, listen, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I just need a break, and I'm just going to, on the couch, and you take your phone, and you. But that's also with preparation. In other words, when you do that in an addictive way, when every 5 minutes you pick up your phone and you're mindlessly scrolling, that's addiction. That causes stress, that causes emptiness, anxiety, actually, right? Because emptiness brings anxiety, right? But saying, you know, I can't keep going all day like a pressure cooker, half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the afternoon, I just do nothing. If that's what you need, that's fine. That's what I meant by doing mindless things with mindfulness, right? That's fine. As long as the plan, that's what I'm saying. Human beings, we need to be robotic. We need to, and sometimes we'll be spontaneous, and that's all good and flexible. Flexibility is important, spontaneity is important, but it has to be a plan, right? And sometimes we'll be spontaneous where we intentionally deviate from our plan, and that's okay. Someone calls us up, it's important, we intentionally are flexible and we deviate from the plan, but not we deviate from the plan because we don't have a plan. We deviate from the plan because we have a plan, right? We're living intentionally. This is the concept, right? And that's a very, very, very important thing. And that goes just another layer of what we spoke about last week about control, self-control, delayed gratification, delayed response. It comes from a general outlook. So therefore, to live inside out from within requires a focus, requires that living intention, to live with intention. Now, part of what that comes from, or comes with, I should say, very, very importantly, is something which the author of the book talks about in one of the chapters, which is not always an easy thing, but it comes with a concept of acceptance. Right? Why do I say it comes with acceptance? Because when I say we have a plan means that we live intentionally and we think carefully about what's the purpose of every experience. But experiences don't always work out the way we want them to work out. And if I do get up in the morning and I make a plan for the day, that plan many times won't work out. Life's plans won't work out, right? And sometimes outside experiences, sometimes less severe, sometimes more severe, are painful, are inconvenient, mess us up, distracting. And it's very easy then to slip and say, well, look, I don't know what to do with this. And we slip into the outside-in model, totally affected by the outside experience, and we lose that focus, and we lose that intention, we lose that purpose, right? Accepting means let me just clarify. Because he says himself about accept, he says, this word can be misleading. So I want to clarify, I'm going to read the paragraph. I want to clarify what I'm saying when I use it. Acceptance means to simply acknowledge what is. It means accepting the right now. Things are the way they are, and that's okay, right? We accept things as they are, even when they're inconvenient, painful, or unjust. But why should we accept things if they aren't what we want? For one simple reason. Because right now, this is the reality, right? In other words, I need to give every experience, every moment, intention. I need to give every moment focus. I need to give every moment purpose. What I can't change is what happens in that moment. I can plan or hope or pray for a better moment, but I can't change this moment. And therefore, a prerequisite to giving this moment the fullest from within, the fullest with purpose, is to accept the moment. Accept the moment doesn't mean to understand the moment. It doesn't mean to make peace with the moment necessarily. It just means to accept it, right? Because that's the moment. That's the reality right now. See, that's the reality right now. That's what I have to live with. And that's my mission. And that's my purpose. And that's the experience I have to give the full intention to. Right? So he gives a couple of examples and he says a very interesting thing. He says we have three options when things happen to us, right? We cannot accept it, which normally leads to us being angry, but we do nothing to change it. Or we can accept it, but acceptance isn't enough. We can accept it, but do nothing about it, right? Or we can accept it and do something about it. Now, do something about it means either do something about changing it, if it's in our control, or sometimes not in our control. So we accept it and do something about giving that moment meaning and purpose. Right? So, the examples, because, you know, I used to give a lot of examples of driving. Lately, I've been giving examples of flying, because I'm getting a lot of frequent flyer points lately. So, right? So exactly like that. I mean, we plan trips, we go on a plane, and then things get delayed, and things get right. And then you know, someone just told me yesterday they had to go to Melbourne, and the flights were cancelled because of a lot of wind. There was wind, and so, right? So, it's a very, I mean, it is an example of not a tragic, so we can talk about it easily. It's not a tragic thing. It's really not a tragedy if you miss a flight to Melbourne. But it's very frustrating, right? Very, very, very frustrating. I just saw a clip the other day on social media, actually, about someone videos different responses of people when flights are cancelled. And like, it's just interesting, although we do it ourselves sometimes, but it's very interesting to stand back and watch human behavior. People screaming at flight attendants. People screaming at people at desk. No, you're going to get me on the flight, right? That's the first option. Don't accept it. Get angry. Get angry even if you know that the person at the desk can do nothing about it because it happens. It is windy outside. And if you don't believe it, you can go outside. And over here, outside the road, there was a whole tree that came down the other day, right? Of course they're going to cancel the flights. There's nothing about the weather that the flight administrator can do anything about, right? But it's just a response because we get angry and frustrated. I need it to be in Melbourne today. Scream, shout, stamp your feet and so on. Or we can just accept it and do nothing about it. Someone gets to the airport. Flights cancel, oh well, waste of an hour. That's not living intentionally either, right? The real response, particularly from a Jewish way of thinking, is accept it and do something about it. Now, it could be there's another option, so go respectfully, quietly, and find another option, a different flight, whatever the case is. But if you can't change it, accept it and do something about it. In other words, why? Because fundamentally this goes to the core of Jewish belief, Hashgacha Pratit. Nothing happens for no reason. So therefore, if it happened, it means that the next hour has to be an hour like every other hour of meaning and purpose. Just you thought the meaning and purpose was an important meeting down in Melbourne. Obviously, it's not. So therefore, it's something now which you have to do. Find a person to talk to. Have a snooze so you can be more refreshed. Learn something. Do someone a favor. Make a call that you can help. Whatever the case is, find something to make that next hour or that night that you all messed up with now meaningful and purposeful. Right? It's very, I mean, I've shared some personal stories with you. It's just because I talk about it so much, therefore, it's been a little bit easier to try and apply, a little bit at least. Right, over the last few months. That's the most amazing, liberating experience. When you can actually get there, which we don't always get there, I certainly don't always get there, but when you do get there, it's the most liberating thing. To actually know, wow, like, I'm really happy. Like, so I didn't do what I was supposed to do, but I'm doing something else. Because what's the purpose of life? To get to that particular goal? No, the purpose of life is to live within. To live with meaning, to live with purpose, live with values. Values are timeless. Values are free. Values don't depend on circumstance. Mitzvot don't depend on circumstance. Connecting to God doesn't depend on where you are and which flight you missed. You can do it everywhere, anywhere, anytime. You just have to find that out. It's by living intentionally. It's about asking the question, why? Not why, sorry. Well, why am I doing this? In other words, what am I going to do about it? Right? I mean, in an extreme level, and I'm only gonna share this with you because he does it in the book, and it's an amazing thing. And most of us are not qualified to talk like this, but and he says himself, he's not qualified to talk like this, but he's gonna quote something from a colleague of his, who he does, and another colleague actually. He mentions his name in the book, but I won't mention the name right now because it's related to people in Sydney and so on. So he talks about a colleague of his, a rabbi, an amazing person actually, who had such tzaras in his life, unbelievable, right? Essentially, some of his kids were born with a particular disease and he lost a number of children. He has some healthy children, but he lost a number of children, right? And he once spoke about it to another person. He said the following, listen to this. Now, this is extreme. And I say, this is like, I'm talking about missing a flight. Missing a flight, we can all aspire to get there, right? This is harder, much, much harder. This is tragedy. But the same principle applies if you can really find the strength to get there. And he said like this, he talked about acceptance. He said, there's a phrase that some people say when they feel that life is not fair. And they say, why is God picking on me? Yet, if you remove one word from that phrase, it changes everything. The word is on. So instead of asking, why is God picking on me? I ask, why is God picking me? It's very deep. If you knew the person, it's unbelievable. I mean, sure. And this person that he's talking about, I happen to know this individual, lives by it. You'll never know. If you meet him, you'll never know. He's happy. Not just faking it, not just putting on a brave face. He's truly happy. He's someone that does amazing things. He hasn't given up. He doesn't live a life of despair at all. He works hard, inspires other people, he teaches, and he's giving life tremendous meaning and purpose, despite. Now, the name's in the book. I don't want to mention the name now because I think I once told you about an old chassid that I knew that really exemplified this. His name was Reb Mendel Futterfass. Reb Mendel Futterfass was a person who spent, I don't know, 8 years, 14 years in Siberia. He was under a communist regime, a very, very, very amazing person. He helped people escape from Russia and then got caught himself. He was going to leave at the end as well after he made sure everyone else leaves of his group, and then he got caught and he got sent to Siberia. His wife and kids were already in England, so he was separated from them, had no contact, and very, very harsh conditions. And he lived by this thing. He said it made no difference where he was. He had one mission in life, and that was to serve God with joy. Right? When he came out of prison and eventually came out of Russia, very shortly after he suffered a tragedy, one of his children was killed in a car accident. And if I didn't tell you this again, if you met this person, you would never know. And he wasn't in denial. He was not in denial at all. Because being in denial is not a good thing. We've spoken about this before. He went through periods, he felt the pain, he grieved, and so on. But he had such inner joy, such purpose, such focus. He's an amazing person. He was a mentor in a yeshiva in Israel. He lived in Israel afterwards. He was my brother, Alav Shalom's mentor. He was his mashpia, as they call it. He knew him very, very well, more than I did. And just taught, and he would say l'chaim with friends, and he would share messages and share stories and inspire people. Just amazing joy, amazing. But you could see it wasn't joy, superficial joy. It was inner joy. He lived a true inside-out life, right? Why? Because he accepted. He believed. He believed everything's from God. He didn't deny the pain. He didn't try and explain why happened or what happened, but he knew that he has to give it meaning. Acceptance means you accept it and you give it meaning. You change what you can change and you give meaning to what you can't change. There's a big philosopher, Rabbi Sacks, quotes an article that says, he who has a why in life, not why do things happen, but why, in other words, why am I existing? Why do I exist? Can bear almost any how. Right? In other words, if we have a why we're here and why do we need to live, we have a purpose, it makes it easier to endure things. But that's all part of the living with intention. Living in intention means to accept each moment for what it is, to believe in Hashgacha Pratit, to believe that each moment was created by God, for sometimes for in ways we don't understand. But therefore, each moment is there to ask, what am I going to do for this moment? How am I going to live intentionally? How am I going to live with a purpose from inside out? Which, I'll just share with you two very quick things, which relates to the previous week's parsha, which the story we read in last Shabbat. Last Shabbat, we read about the life of Sarah. And the Torah says that Sarah lived 127 years, but the way the Torah says it is, it says it lived 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. It doesn't say 127 years. It says 100 years. And Rashi, the commentator, quotes one of the Talmudic phrases that the idea of the Torah saying 100 years, 20 years, 7 years is that when she was 100, she was like 20. What that meant was that for her, the whole life was equal. Kulan shavin letova. Her life was equally good. Now, if you look at the history of Sarah, you will know and discover that Sarah's life was anything but equally good, right? She had lots of challenges in life. She had lots of problems. She was captured and kidnapped by Pharaoh. She was kidnapped by Avimelech. She was childless for many years. Lots of things happened to her that were very bad. Kulan shavin letova means that they were all equally good because they were equally purposeful. She lived with intention. To her, it actually didn't make a difference whether it was good or bad. It made a difference, obviously, but it didn't make a difference in terms of a life mission. Whatever she went through, they were all equal in terms of purpose, in terms of goodness, real goodness, which is living a life with purpose. Which links into a very fascinating story, which I'll just end with the story, that the Talmud says. The Talmud says that Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, was once... Now, Rabbi Akiva was a person who lived in terrible times, under Roman rule, right? But Rabbi Akiva was once giving a shiur, a drasha. He was giving a drasha to his students, and he noticed, I guess this is an age-old problem, he noticed that during his drasha, his students were falling asleep, right? So he decided he had to say something to wake them up. So he changed topic. Good strategy. He changed topic, and he suddenly says, I'd like to pose a question. And they all, okay? You know, all of a sudden the topic changes, he's posing a question, so they were up. And this is the simple meaning of the story, right? And he says to them, in the book of Esther, in the book of Purim, why did Esther rule over 127 provinces, right? Because Esther becomes Ahasuerus' wife. Ahasuerus was the king who the Megillah tells us ruled over 127 provinces. So therefore Esther became the queen of 127 provinces. Why? What did she do to merit that? So they're looking at him, that's like, whoa. Strange question. So he says, I'll tell you the answer. She ruled over 127 provinces because she was a descendant of Sarah who lived 127 years. Okay. So the commentaries say, I mean, we all are descendants of Sarah. I mean, she's the matriarch of everyone, right? So what's this supposed to mean? What was the question? What was the answer? I mean, I know you have to wake him up, but I mean, you can't say something that makes sense. So I wanted a beautiful commentary, the depth of the story. What it means that the Talmidim were falling asleep doesn't mean they were falling asleep. Rabbi Akiva lived in a terrible time. It was a time of despair, a time of torture, a time of a real evil regime. They're trying to prevent them from studying Torah. They're trying to at least kill them and torture them. It was a terrible time. So Rabbi Akiva, as he's teaching his students, he sees that his students are falling asleep. They're starting to despair. They're giving up. So he had to inspire them. So he said, why did Esther rule of 127 provinces? Like, Esther lived in a very tough time. Where did Esther get that strength from? How did Esther continue going? She lived in the time of Ahasuerus, which was a time where there was a decree of a complete destruction of the Jewish nation. Where did Esther learn this from? Said Rabbi Akiva, from Sarah. That Sarah lived 127 years, and Kulan Shavin Latova, they were all equally good. The good times and the bad times. Why? Because she lived with purpose. That's how he woke his students up. He said, you cannot despair. You have to accept. You cannot despair. You have to pray and be determined and ask God and beg God that the next moment should be good. But right now, this is the moment you were given. This is the moment you have to have. And this is the moment you can give purpose to. And that's what it means to live intentionally. When you live intentionally, you can live mindfully. When you can live with purpose, you can accept. And then you can enhance that inside-out model. Next week's the last session of this year, as I said. And we're going to try and just wrap it all up and share some more concepts. Have a wonderful week.